Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Israeli forces once again attack Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, leaving dozens of worshippers injured. Hamas says it is closely monitoring the situation in Palestinian territories and is fully ready to respond to Israeli crimes. And Germany reportedly displaces hundreds of Afghan refugees to make room for Ukrainians fleeing the conflict in their country. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. In occupied Al-Quds, Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. So far, 43 Palestinians are confirmed injured. Israeli forces made arrests too. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement said it is closely monitoring the situation there and it is fully ready to respond to Israeli crimes against Palestinian people. Hamas also called on the international community to restrain the occupying Israeli regime and stop its aggression against Al-Aqsa. Tensions at the holy site began last Friday when Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers, injuring scores. The aggression is taking place during the fasting month of Ramadan. We reached out to our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, to get more details about the latest attack.
Well, first of all, we can say that it's clear Israeli intentions are to keep Palestinians away from the Al-Aqsa Mosque and to prevent Muslim Palestinians of freedom of worship inside Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. What happened this morning is that Palestinian worshippers entered the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex in order to perform the morning prayers. Hundreds of them preferred to remain in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and not to leave it. They were chanting when Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. They were chanting, Allahu Akbar, Allah is great. And they wanted to remain there because it's a Friday. And they want to remain there in order to perform the Friday prayers. They were thinking that in case they left the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex, the Israeli soldiers might not allow them to return back to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. That's why Israeli police raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, attacked the people. They fired tear gas, rubber-coated bullets towards the worshippers and tried to force them out. As you have mentioned, a number of Palestinians have been wounded.
The Arab League breaks its silence on the recent Israeli violation at Al-Aqsa. The League says Israel must stop restricting Muslims from worshipping while allowing ultranationalist Jews to enter the sacred site. The organization says that Israel has broken the status quo and is now allowing Jews to pray at the compound under police protection. In a statement, the League called on Israel to stop such practice and also warned that a flagrant affront of Muslims risks a cycle of violence and threatens stability in the region and the world. The statement follows an emergency meeting of the League in which member states discuss illegal Israeli policies in Al-Quds. Saad Nimer, a professor of political science, says the Arab League is only releasing statements against Israel when it should take actions to stop the regime's aggression against Palestinians.
It's most of them are already, they have a relationship with Israel and have a peace process with Israel or peace treaties, and they are normalizing the relationship with Israel. When we are talking about Morocco or talking about Emirates or even Jordan and Egypt,
and Bahrain,
what do you expect? What do you expect? You know, the outcome of such a meeting? Yes, they condemn and they say, you know, statements, and but there is no actions, and that is way nothing in front of what's going on. As well as you mentioned, it came too late a little bit. You know, we are ending now the whole situation by the Palestinian resistance from Gaza, and they try to claim that they are, you know, pressurizing Israel in a way or another. What kind of pressure they put on Israel by, you know, having a statement to condemn what the Israelis are doing and asking Israel and asking the international community to take responsibility in preventing these incursions on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We believe that this was, you know, not worth even the meeting or even the ink that they wrote these kind of statements.
The run-up to International Quds Day, a UK-based rights group, is calling on supporters of the Palestinian struggle to lift their voices in support and solidarity. The 2022 edition of the Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is an opportunity to remind Palestinians living under occupation and the diaspora that they are not alone. Amina Taylor reports.
Violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive to those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing.
Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag.
As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, you know, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute, and you know they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the devastated port city of Mariupol continues to resist despite Russian claims to have captured it. Zelensky said in the south and the east of the country, Russia does everything to talk about some victories. But he added Russian forces will ultimately have to leave Ukrainian territory, and that is inevitable. On Thursday, Russia said that it has, quote, liberated Mariupol after weeks of besieging the southern port city. President Vladimir Putin hailed this as a success for Russian forces. The Ukraine war is now in its 58th day. Moscow says it aims to demilitarize Ukraine and has intensified attacks in recent days. In the meantime, the West has also stepped up its military aid to Kiev. The war in Ukraine not only shows no signs of ending, but seems to be prolonging. One of the reasons behind the war not ending anytime soon, the U.S. pumping arms into Ukraine. The most recent sale, another $800 million. Why is the U.S. keen on giving Ukraine so much in military aid? Russia has warned the U.S. and NATO against continuing to arm Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine is raging on. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is entering a new phase, which is focused on eastern Ukraine as the opposing troops remain locked in combat along a 300-mile front line. The Russian Defense Ministry has given the Ukrainian forces an ultimatum to lay down their arms. Ukraine has reached a preliminary agreement with Russia to evacuate civilians. But the United States and its allies seem to be determined to prolong the war. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to announce within the coming days another military aid package for Ukraine about the same size as the $800 million one announced last week.
Well, I think as has been the case since former President Eisenhower warned about the threat of the rising threat of the military-industrial complex, in his speech as he left the White House, as his presidency came to an end, the United States, and specifically the private companies that have contracts with the U.S. government, the military-industrial complex, Boeing, Raytheon, et cetera, have very much a vested interest in keeping the U.S. in current wars as well as provoking new ones.
It will include artillery systems, artillery rounds, armored personnel carriers, and unmanned coastal defense boats. It would bring the total U.S. military aid to Ukraine since the Russian military offensive in February to well over $3 billion. Kiev has called for additional weapons and support to stave off Moscow's new offensive in the eastern Donbas region, where Russian forces have been amassing after their withdrawal from the Ukrainian capital. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also said Canada would be sending heavy artillery and promised to provide more details.
The United States very much has a financial interest in the companies and the corporations, the military corporations and weapons manufacturing of the United States does have an interest in probably not going into the war head on and starting a full-on hot war with Russia, but keeping tensions high, keeping Russian forces tied up in the Donbass, in the eastern part of Ukraine for as long as possible.
The U.S. has so far provided over $3 billion in military equipment to Ukraine, and this figure is just under the Biden presidency. Recently, the U.K. doubled the number of its missiles given to Ukraine, totaling 10,000. Britain is also providing 2.5 million items of weaponry and military equipment amounting to more than £1.5 billion. Meanwhile, the number of deaths is going up as the military sales continue.
There are some reports that the U.S. is using the Ukraine conflict to prepare for wars against Russia and China. The U.S. military is training to fight in an environment heavily shaped by the Russian military campaign against Ukraine that was launched about 2 months ago. The purpose of this month's war game in California is to prepare for future wars against Russia and China. The report said the role players in the exercise at the Fort Irwin National Training Center in the Mojave Desert speak Russian. About 4,500 soldiers from the 2nd Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division are pitted against the fictional Devonian forces, the exercise's apparent stand-in for the Russians. The enemy fires rockets and missiles in the drill, all while using a sophisticated disinformation campaign to make false accusations against U.S. troops.
So I think that the United States, the U.S. corporations, the U.S. government, the officials within United States politics and economics have their head on straight enough to know that an open war with Russia is against their profit motive, is against their motive for world domination, because there simply would be no world left to dominate.
The U.S. has also warned China that it will face consequences if it helps Russia evade sanctions in its invasion of Ukraine. China has so far refrained from condemning Russia for the invasion and has said Moscow's legitimate security concerns should be taken seriously. There has also been growing tensions between Beijing and Washington and its allies in the Asia-Pacific region, including over Taiwan and the South China Sea. The Pentagon and U.S. lawmakers cited countering China in passing this year's $777.7 billion defense budget.
Germany has reportedly displaced hundreds of Afghan refugees to make room for Ukrainians fleeing the conflict back home. A report by U.S. media shows the government in Berlin has told Afghan refugees that there was no alternative since Ukrainians, quote, needed a roof over their heads. The Afghan refugees say social workers came with eviction notices, giving them 24 hours to clear out the houses. The Berlin Refugee Council has expressed concern over the government's biased treatment of refugees in the past few months. Social workers have also voiced frustration over the treatment of Afghans, as well as other West Asian and North African refugees in Germany. In 2021, some 12,000 Afghans arrived in Germany after the Taliban takeover. Moving on, new data shows that U.S. police have killed nearly 600 people during traffic stops since 2017, with such deaths continuing quickly this year. The data was released by a research group mapping police violence. They show that there were 97 deadly traffic stops in the U.S. in 2017. The figure continues to rise in the recent years afterwards, where at least 117 people were killed. This year alone, 22 such deaths were registered as of April. The data also shows that deadly traffic stops mostly target black people. The latest such incident took place in Michigan earlier this month when unarmed Patrick Loyola was killed during an encounter with a white policeman. His death added voices to call for an end to U.S. police brutality against the black community. It also raises calls for removing armed police from traffic enforcement. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The city of Al-Quds, the jewel of the Islamic world. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. In this series of programs, we shall discuss the significance of designating the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan as International Quds Day. This subject has taken on added importance in view of recent efforts by the Zionist regime to normalize its ties with a number of Arab countries. Please stay with us. The blessed month of Ramadan is very important for the entire Muslim world. Muslim countries congratulate each other with the arrival of this holy month, and the Islamic world's largest and most important festivity, Eid al-Fitr, is at the end of this month. Ramadan is a month of worship and supplication to the Almighty. Muslims pray to God before the break of dawn and refrain from eating and drinking from dawn till dusk. But fasting in the month of Ramadan isn't just about not eating. During this month, Muslims strive not to commit any sins. They also eschew any behavior or talk contrary to humanitarian and ethical values. In actual fact, Ramadan is the month where ethical, moral, and humanitarian values manifest themselves. A great example of moral and humanitarian values is to fight injustice and oppression, and to defend those who have been oppressed. In our times, the genocide and expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland surely ranks as the most prominent act of tyranny and oppression in contemporary world history. The founder of the Islamic Republic and the great leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, in support of the Palestinian cause and in opposition to a tyrannical regime, designated the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as World Quds Day. In February 1979, in the first month of Ramadan, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini declared the last Friday of the month of Ramadan as the World Quds Day, so that all Muslims and freedom-seeking nations of this world can call for the liberation of Al-Quds and show their support for the oppressed Palestinians. The rallies, marches, and other events held on this day will raise awareness and demonstrate international support for the just struggle of the Palestinian people. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, right from the start of his uprising against the despotic Pahlavi regime, supported the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people. The Imam's goal was liberation of occupied Palestine. By designating the last Friday of Ramadan as International Quds Day, the Imam highlighted the danger posed by Zionism and kept alive the Palestinian struggle. He drew the attention of Islamic nations and all Muslims to the problem of Palestine. But the Imam had another objective with this designation. He reacted to the betrayal of the Palestinian cause by Egypt's Anwar Sadat, who had signed the scandalous Camp David Accord with the fake Zionist regime, officially recognizing the Tel Aviv regime. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, issued an important statement on August 8, 1979, on the subject of World Quds Day, declaring, "I have pointed out the danger of the usurper Israeli regime to Muslims everywhere, over a period of many years. The usurper regime is intensifying its attack on our Palestinian brothers and sisters. And, particularly in southern Lebanon, the Israeli regime is relentlessly bombarding Palestinian homes, killing Palestinian fighters. I call on Muslims throughout the world and all Islamic governments to unite forthwith and confront this usurper regime and stand up to its aggression. I invite all Muslims to select the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan as Quds Day, and in a ceremony, display their international support for Muslim Palestinians and their lawful rights. I beseech the Almighty to grant victory to Muslims and make them emerge triumphant against the disbelievers. In another message setting out the importance of naming the last Friday of Ramadan as Quds Day, the late Imam said, Quds Day is truly an international day. It doesn't just belong to Quds. It is the day where the oppressed confront their oppressors. The downtrodden take on the arrogant powers. It is the day where nations who suffered under the yoke and tyranny of the United States rise up. It is the day where the downtrodden should be appropriately equipped in the face of the arrogant powers, and the arrogant should be forced to bow. Quds Day is Islam's day. It is the day for reviving Islam. The Islamic laws should be implemented in Islamic countries. In fact, Quds Day symbolizes unity and determination of the Islamic Ummah vis-à-vis the crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Palestine, Gaza, and other Islamic lands. In fact, the blood of Palestinians has unmasked Zionism and revealed the true face of this usurper regime. In Islamic Iran, just as in all other countries, masses of people throng to the streets showing their support for the Palestinian struggle, and in marches and rallies call for liberation of occupied Palestine. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, commented on International Quds Day by saying, "The dawn of the Islamic Revolution in Iran opened up a new chapter in the struggle for occupied Palestine. From the first steps which we took, namely expelling Zionists from Iran, Zionists who considered Iran as one of their safest bases in the region, to converting the unofficial Israeli embassy to the Palestinian embassy in Tehran, to cutting off the supply of oil, and extensive political activity which led to the creation of a resistance front in the entire region. For the first time, real hope for solving the Palestinian issue was raised." Commenting on the changing of political equations in the region after the Islamic Resistance Front took shape, the leader said, "With the emergence of Islamic Resistance Front, it became harder and harder for the Zionist regime, and this trend is set to continue into the future, inshallah. On the other hand, the efforts of the supporters of this regime, first among them the United States, has also increased substantially. The emergence of a young, faithful, highly committed, and self-sacrificing force such as Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the emergence of highly motivated resistance movements such as Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Palestine itself have not only worried the leadership in Israel, but have caused huge dismay in the United States and other Western countries which back Israel. Currently, full military support, providing both hardware and software for the Israeli regime, as well as finding allies within the Arab world, are just some of the assistance provided by Israel's Western backers. The treacherous actions and words of some Arab governments and the open betrayal of some Arab politicians and cultural figures vis-à-vis the Palestinian cause is obvious for all to see and is no longer a secret." Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the just struggle of the Palestinian people to liberate their occupied homeland had not borne fruit. Despite all their efforts, the Palestinians had failed to liberate their homeland from the clutches of the fake Zionist regime. The reasons for this failure were several. Palestinians had little financial, material, and spiritual support for the international community. There was division among Islamic and Arab nations, and the Palestinian resistance groups themselves were divided. United States and Europe provided extensive support and propaganda in favor of the Israeli regime. The United States and Europe provided extensive support and propaganda in favor of the Israeli regime. The Western champions of human rights and freedom apparently couldn't care less about the human rights and freedom of Palestinians. The weak ideology of Palestinian resistance groups, the dearth of new ideas, organizational problems, and their failure to mobilize the masses had also contributed to the poor performance of the Palestinians vis-à-vis the Israeli regime. Some Arabs had even begun to take seriously the myth of invincibility of the Zionist regime and the United States. The 1979 Camp David Accord between the Israeli regime and Egypt further disheartened the Arab masses and the Palestinians, adding to the gloom and despair. But all that changed very dramatically in favor of the Palestinians when the Islamic Revolution triumphed in Iran in 1979. Iran's wholehearted and comprehensive support for the Palestinians provided them with substantial financial and material support, as well as ideological backing. This resulted in the marginalization of leftist and Marxist ideology among Palestinian resistance groups, with Islam taking front and center stage. A prominent Palestinian resistance leader, Sheikh Asad Tamimi, commented on the effects of the Islamic Revolution on the struggles of the Palestinian nation when he said, "Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Islam hadn't entered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Even the choice of words was telling. Instead of jihad, the Palestinians tended to use words such as nidhal and kafa. But the Islamic Revolution in Iran revealed this reality and true principle to the Palestinian people. Islam is the solution, and jihad or uprising is the main means of attaining this solution." Leftist and Marxist ideology among Palestinian resistance groups gradually lost their appeal, and this was the main effect of the Islamic Revolution on the Palestinian people's struggle. Another effect was the special status of mosques and religious leaders in the Palestinian struggle. Their ability to mobilize the masses led to the intifada of the Palestinian people. The martyred General Secretary and founder of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Dr. Fatih Shaghaghi, had this to say about the effect of the Islamic Revolution on the Palestinian people's resistance. "Nothing excited the Palestinian nation and aroused their emotions as the revolution of Imam Khomeini. It motivated them and revived their hopes. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we were awakened and we realized that Israel and the United States could be defeated. We obtained inspiration from Islam and realized that miracles were possible. The struggling Palestinian nation regards the Islamic Revolution as fate or destiny and considers Imam Khomeini as one of the eternal leaders of Islam."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The National Urban League, who has said that the median household income for black people in the U.S. is 37% lower than that of white people. Why does racism in all of its forms, like in this case income, still persist in the U.S. to the extent that it does? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why it is difficult for people of color to overcome systemic racism in the U.S. in all of its forms.
It really should have
An annual report by a New York-based civil rights organization has once again turned the spotlight on systemic racism and bias in the United States. The National Urban League's report showed that African Americans, despite making economic and health gains, still get just about 74% of what white people enjoy in the country. The organization demonstrates how difficult it is for people of color to overcome systemic racism.
These numbers change so little and so slowly. What it tells me is that this institutional disparity based on race seems to be built into American society.
The findings show the median household income for black people is 37% less than that of white people and are less likely to benefit from home ownership. The report also touches upon educational gaps.
Black and white preschoolers are roughly equally prepared, but the classrooms they enter are starkly different. Schools with more minority students are more likely to have inexperienced, less trained, and even uncertified teachers. Fewer of these students are enrolled in the STEM classes that can lead to higher paying jobs. Black students are less likely to graduate from college.
On voting rights, the report says state legislatures have been restricting voting access in districts with large populations of Black Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. The report also points to U.S. Justice Department statistics saying Black people have been more than twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience threats or uses of force during police encounters, and three times more likely to be jailed if arrested. The grim findings come nearly 2 years after the U.S. underwent a major reckoning on racism following the brutal killing of African-American George Floyd by a white police officer. His death ignited nationwide protests and demands for equality and end to police brutality against people of color. Nonetheless, the National Urban League's report has highlighted the fact that racial inequality in the U.S. is deep-rooted. It stems from years of injustice and institutionalized racism against African Americans and other minority groups, which worsened during Donald Trump's presidency. Anti-racism demonstrations have also failed to bring about any tangible change in previous years.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, who joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, Joseph Richardson, professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland from Laurel, Maryland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Gerald Horn, let me first start with you. And I have to say, if you did not catch on, that this was a report by the civil rights group National Urban League. So obviously your opinion of that organization is very important. But basically, one of the conclusions it has reached is that systemic racism is holding back black Americans. And it says black people in the U.S. are trailing white people in critical areas. That includes wealth, education, social justice, health, and civic engagement. Are you surprised at that, first of all?
No, I'm not surprised. And those who are surprised have not been paying attention to U.S. history. That is to say, when the European settlers and colonists began invading in North America in the 1500s and 1600s, they set up a society that was exclusive. It was only tended to benefit those who were like themselves. They liquidated the indigenous population for the most part, and then handcuffed Africans and dragged them across the Atlantic to be slaves. And we have not been able to transcend that original sin to the point where, as your reporter suggested, the prisons are overflowing with Black Americans. Black Americans are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, that is to say, executed by the arm of the state. Black people are more likely to be shot down in the streets by the police forces. And with regard to housing discrimination, the latest revelation is that if a Black person is trying to sell their home, they find they can get more for their home if they take down the pictures on the walls of their Black relatives and leave the walls bare or put up pictures of those who are defined as white. I can think of no worse example of the kind of white supremacy that obtains in the United States of America.
Joseph Richardson, you know, this National Urban League actually produced the first state of Black America in its report that, based on what it said, it captured the plight of the people who had been victims of systemic racism since arriving, as it said, in the shores of the U.S. And when you take a look at the year that report was published, it was back in 1976. Of course, Gerald Horn there goes back even further. When you have organizations like this and similar to this issuing out alarm bells and describing how this systemic racism is going on, and it's still, based on its most recent report, is even in some sense gotten worse, then why aren't there any action plans set forward, or have they, and it's just not working?
I believe that there have been action plans that have been set forward, and there are many scholars who have addressed the wealth gap in this country. We only need to look at the work of economist Sandy Darity at Duke University, who has been making the argument for reparations, and we've heard discussions and policies recommending and advocating for reparations across this nation. But if to hark back onto the work of Dr. Darity found just in terms of the wealth gap in America, and it's quite interesting that we often emphasize the educational gaps, but what Dr. Darity found in terms of the differences in wealth is that white Americans, even those who have not graduated from high school and dropped out of high school, have greater wealth than Black Americans who have a college degree. And so his argument is that there really isn't a way to educate ourselves out of the great wealth gap and disparities that we have between Blacks and whites without having another form of remediation, and that would be in the form of reparations. Because as you mentioned, that report was made in 1976, and not much has changed in terms of Black wealth over the past 50 years. And in fact, we know that during the Obama administration, Black Americans actually lost more wealth because much of our wealth has been tied to home ownership. And so that intergenerational transference of wealth hasn't happened in the same way for Black Americans as it is traditionally benefited white Americans in this country.
One of the most alarming, at least in terms of what I saw, Gerald Horn, of this report, is how it talked about voting rights. And taking a look at the statement that it made there, it was very interesting in the way that it described it. And it said that it was actually an anti-democratic move that began after the 2008 election, when Black voting rates actually matched white voting rates for the first time, which catapulted Barack Obama into office. This sounds an awful lot like a UN report that recently came out talking about voting rights of minorities denied in parts of the U.S., mentioning Texas as one of those states. That sounds like Black voting is being, or Black votes are being suppressed. Is that what this is about, which is resulting in gerrymandering? And perhaps you can describe that for us.
Well, gerrymandering is the process whereby congressional districts or state legislative districts are drawn in such a way as to oftentimes dilute the effectiveness of the Black vote. That is normative, particularly in a state like Texas. You also need to realize that one of the reasons that this takes place is that the Black voter tends to vote against conservatives, vote against the Republicans, vote against the right wing at a higher rate than any other demographic category. oftentimes reaching 9-1. And so it is in the material interest of the conservatives, of the Republicans, to try to dilute, if not obliterate, Black voting power. If that were the only problem that we faced, of course, that would be formidable. But to return to the economic question, there is the question of employment discrimination. You've had recently attempts to pass laws, for example, to prevent employers from discriminating against people who have hair like mine. That is to say, it's quite usual, quite typical for Black women to face discrimination because of having hair like this, a category that they have nothing to do with. That is the essence, obviously, of blatant discrimination. And the fact that you have to pass a law to address that says more than I could ever articulate.
Well, if you want to talk about the economy, this is definitely an eye-opener. And it's not new news. Joseph Richardson, I don't know if you're even aware of it. Hopefully you are, and perhaps you can spread the word. But there was one report that came out in 2020 by a major U.S. Banking group, Citigroup, that said the U.S. economy has lost $16 trillion because of discrimination. Now, this, again, it came out in 2020. There was another report that came out that was cited by the San Francisco Federal Reserve President Mary Daly that said that the racial and ethnic inequities have cost the U.S. economy some $51 trillion. Now, I do have to say, this is not just lost revenue from Blacks, but also people of color. But still, it's a really large figure. You would think the U.S. government would address this, and I think at some point Joe Biden did address that in his presidential campaign, that he is aware of this.
Well, while President Biden may be aware of it, again, it takes the political will of our policymakers in order to implement and execute policies that will actually effectively address these issues. And so, again, I think what you're saying is has an historical context to it. The work of Lisa Cook, an economist at Michigan State, does some really rigorous scholarship in terms of Black patents and the number of patents that have been stolen from Black scientists and inventors, and what that has cost the U.S. economy, I think contributes in many respects to the number that you just noted. But we also have to think in terms of and the number of people that are not leaving, that are unable to get a college education, who can create and contribute to the economy by being scientists and incubators of innovation, and how that has impacted Black Americans as well, in addition to preventing us from entering into small businesses by preventing us from getting loans. And we recently saw in Wells Fargo, just in terms of Black wealth again, that far more Black applicants were denied recently from getting home loans and particularly refinancing loans than white applicants. And so all of this in combination, whether it's the lack of our being able to build our human capital, which ultimately may tie into our social and financial capital, plays an instrumental role in accumulating our wealth. And so the statistics that you just noted, I don't find them surprising at all, understanding and knowing the context of the way structural racism has played out in terms of even the scientists and innovation in terms of patents among Black people in this country.
Sure. And of course, Gerald Horn, I do have to say that this is not something that the U.S. is just the U.S. experiencing, but also a phenomenon around the world. When this report was described, Gerald Horn, it said, in different, mind you, websites, it said that the report came nearly 2 years after the U.S. experienced what it called a major reckoning on racism in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. Now, we know that this type of racism has existed before. Do you agree, or what do you think the reason is that the report, or the description of the report, is stated as such, that it comes after what it calls a major reckoning after the death of George Floyd, or the killing of George Floyd?
Well, I would say that it was a reckoning. I'm not so sure it was a major reckoning, because if it was a major reckoning, we would not be discussing the dismal report that's now on our agenda. for those who may not recall, in May 2020, the black man known as George Floyd was executed on tape by police officers in the state of Minnesota. That led to mass protests across the country and indeed in many parts of the world. That is the so-called major reckoning that took place. But it takes more, I'm afraid to say, than a spate of demonstrations to erode the encrusted bigotry that has accumulated over the decades and over the centuries in the United States of America. And in fact, I dare say that given the fact that inflation is now racking the U.S. economy, and indeed the economies of a goodly number of advanced capitalist countries, you can expect these kinds of dismal reports to be issued regularly. Because when there are economic downturns, oftentimes the rate and regularity of racism accelerates. And I'm afraid to say that that's maybe on the agenda as we speak.
Well, it's very alarming, I would think, Joseph Richardson, when you take a look at what the report has said regarding representation in Congress. And it said people of color made up 90% of the population growth in North Carolina, 95% of the population growth in Texas. Yet the communities of color in those states have seen decreased representation in Congress. Now, if I'm in the White House and I'm reading this, I should be alarmed, because what if this were to spread to more states? Because as this report indicated, for example, you have a major increase in the number of populations that are the spending that occurs from consumers, and at the same time, you have, for example, incomes that are 37% less than that of white people, as is said for black people. My question being, there needs to be an equality of some sorts to be applied here, whether it's a representation in Congress, income, and what have you. Do you see any major movements to that effect?
No, but I would say that we have not had the same level of representation in Congress that was reflective of the black population since Reconstruction. We had far more senators and congressmen that were of African-American descent in Congress during Reconstruction than we've had since then. So, I mean, there's a historical context to this, which isn't just playing out recently. I mean, we're talking about well over 100 years. So, and just in terms of, we need to think about in terms of who we are voting for. How are we casting our vote? Dr. Horn mentioned that we typically vote against conservatives, but we also have to revisit, just in terms of our own economic health and survival, what has the Democratic Party done to deliver our vote? And we have several scholars that have made the argument that maybe African Americans should form more of a voting bloc than to just freely give their vote over to the Democratic Party, because it hasn't resulted in any kind of economic advancement for black Americans, whether in terms of economically or even in terms of our civil rights agenda. And so, again, I think we need to retrench and think more critically about what has the Democratic Party done for black Americans in terms of advancing our economics, advancing the health of our communities, our life expectancy, and the educational systems, as well as the criminal justice system, which we haven't seen many gains for African Americans, regardless of what party we choose to elect and place into office. And so maybe it is time for us to think about how we can leverage our vote in terms of leveraging our vote with who needs our vote the most in terms of what we will get out of it, and in terms of placing it, specific candidates in office, and not thinking specifically along party lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gerald Horn, what do you think about that? At this point, do you see the Democratic Party failing in delivering on its promises, especially when it comes to either people of color or African-Americans or blacks? Or do you see that the Democratic Party is not doing that, and therefore there needs to be another kind of representation for, and I'm going to put people of color as a whole, and then blacks or African-Americans specifically?
Well, I would like to add another factor, which is that if you look historically, the crucial and critical factor that helps to propel Black people in particular forward has been the global context. It's no accident that U.S. apartheid, legalized discrimination and racism, began to retreat 70-odd years ago when the United States is under international pressure as African and Caribbean nations are coming to independence and the socialist camp is bidding for influence amongst those nations. The U.S. decides that the better part of wisdom is to try to execute an agonizing retreat away from the more egregious and horrible aspects of Jim Crow. I agree that left to its own devices, the road ahead for Black people will be quite rocky. But that's where our international allies, particularly our allies and friends in Iran, can intervene, because just as our friends in Iran are under pressure from Washington and from the right wing and from those who rule the United States, Black people are under pressure from the right wing as well. So I would urge our friends overseas, not least in Iran, to speak out on our behalf, because that would be in your interest and that would be in our interest.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. We appreciate that. Gerald Horn, Professor of History and African American Studies from the University of Houston. Thank you so much. Joseph Richardson, thank you. Professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at the University of Maryland. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. In the realm of truth, we have two very dear guests. Now I want them to introduce themselves to you. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum, I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK and I'm studying in the holy city of Qom, alhamdulillah.
Such a pleasure to be with you. So you're studying religion?
Yeah, I'm studying in the Hawza.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm Sadiqa from the UK as well, and I'm studying in Qom as well in the Sisters Hawza. And my field of study is Fiqh and Usul. Fiqh and Usul is basically the principles of jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm. Very great. Maybe it has happened to us many times, or at least we have seen that in different groups. As we were students, we saw that at school. And also as we grew up, we saw that at universities. When we are in a group and there is a person who is weaker than the others, or he is a stranger, he's a newcomer, he is an easy target. He or she is an easy target. They are easier to be excluded from the group. They're easier to be pointing at them like, you are the one who is to be blamed, and something like that. What are the reasons for that? Why do we feel like that when we are in a group, or when we are even in the families? That might happen as well. There are always, I have seen at least, in some families, that there are children who are easier than the others to be blamed. The others do the wrong things, and the younger one is going to be blamed for what the elder one did, or the vice versa. What are the reasons behind that? Why such thing exists in human beings?
Human beings are a scary creation, to be honest. A very weak creation of Allah, initially at least. And we're always looking for a scapegoat. human beings, and this is a behavior pattern.
Exactly, as scapegoats.
You can see it in family circles. You can see it in schools. You know,